Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
This is top and tailing the
podcast. Yeah, I know. The thing is, I just finished doing a bunch of film reviews.
Shut up a second. Right, Lee, you ready? Okay, here we go. Hello and welcome to the very latest Wittertainment podcast. Mark is here.
Hello, Simon.
The audience in Newcastle is here.
And the audience in Newcastle is also here.
Yeah, my cheer was much bigger than yours. We also have a studio announcer called Lee. Hello, Lee.
Hello, everybody.
Okay. And he's only here as our announcer because the podcast has an announcer. We thought, well, we're the original show. Why should they just have the announcer?
But our announcer has to be louder than the podcast announcer because listeners have written in to say the podcast announcer is too loud.
Right.
How loud are you?
Lee, can you just say as loud as you possibly can, welcome to the Wittertainment Podcast.
Welcome to the Wittertainment Podcast.
This is Simon Mayo on 5 Live, live from Newcastle. Sorry, I'll try that again. Live from Newcastle. We're here for 2 hours at Wittertainment between now and 4 o'clock with these movies to be discussed.
You're here to be lynched as a Southern Jesse boy. We're going to be talking about the Horde, or La Horde, to give it its French title, Winter's Bone, the Sundancer Award winner. What else are we doing? Oh, I'm Still Here, the Joaquin Phoenix Is It, Isn't It documentary about the actor deciding that he doesn't want to be an actor anymore, but be a rapper instead.
Yes, we are in Newcastle Centre for Life. We're at we've been put in, for some bizarre reason, the Banqueting and Conference Hall, which is where we're all squeezed in. There are disco balls in the roof. Look at them. There's 8 disco balls, which we'll turn on later for an exciting finale to the programme. Outside, there's a big advert for the Ladyboys of Bangkok. Inside, the most knowledgeable film audience that you can find. Would you put your hands together, please, for a man who has 2 large ones of his own, Dr. Mark Kermode.
Hands. I can't believe you made that joke.
There's a public toilet just through the doors here.
Where is this going?
In the bathroom.
What? We've been on there for like 2 minutes.
There's one of those hand dryer things, right? Where you put one of those.
It's an air blade. It's not a hand dryer. It's an air blade.
It's an air blade. And there's one there. There's for ordinary sized hands. And then just next to it.
Yeah, right. Well, since you're doing that, can I just say, outside there is a huge tent, which you've all probably seen, with the advert for the Ladyboys from Bangkok. And is that, presumably that's where Ladyboys from Bangkok is playing, in the tent, is it? I don't know. And so there's a picture of all these, you know, ladyboys from Bangkok. And as we walked past, Simon, who clearly has grown up in Narnia, went, they're not ladyboys, they're ladies.
They're just clearly look like all ladies.
No, Simon.
The boys bit is made up. Has anyone been to see the show? The Ladyboys of Bangkok.
Are they ladies or are they ladyboys? They're lady boys, Simon. Okay, that's why the clue is in the title, Lady Boys of Bangkok.
I think we've got someone at the back. I just want an
instant review.
Is one
of the lady boys of Bangkok here?
Well, they're going to come on and do a little show. In fact, they're in the... No. Are you going to do an instant review, please, of the lady boys of Bangkok? Who had the hand up? They've gone all shy all of a sudden. As soon as the microphone turns up, they think, oh, I'm not going to go on. And who's the... Yes, hello, who are you?
Julie.
Hello, Julie.
Hi.
Have you been to see the ladyboys at Bangkok?
A couple of years ago, yes.
Are they the same ladyboys?
Oh.
Have you not moved on a bit?
I think there might be different ones.
Oh, really? Was it a good show?
It was good fun, as long as you'd had a couple of glasses of wine before.
Just like this programme, really. I put a photo on Twitter earlier of... there's a big 5 Live ad, and then just above it, there's a Ladyboys of Bangkok ad. And Steve Babb tweeted back, one is a musical starring perfectly coiffed, flappy gents. The other is a national radio presentation. So here we are. You can email, of course, as ever, mayo@bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. We'll do a box office top 10. This is the most knowledgeable film audience that you're going to find. You can join in at home. This email from Mark in Rochester. Dear insert funny name A here and insert funny name B here. When passing a local nightclub, I have noticed that there's something on this Saturday and I'm sure Dr. K will want to attend. Uh-huh. I have attached a picture of the nightclub's banners. In summary, it says, Danny Dyer, Saturday the 18th, live DJ set, meet and greet and pictures with the man himself. I'm sure Dr. K won't want to miss that. Unfortunately, I am washing my hair, says Mark, on Saturday, so I won't be able to meet and greet the man himself. But what would you say to him if you met him?
Well, I mean, you know, how much I've enjoyed his many film films. He's got a biography coming out, which is called... Hang on, I read this just the other day. It's called Straight Up, Honest, No Really! All words to that effect.
That's our first...
Governor!
That's our first impression. And what this audience in Newcastle now... Can I just say, I'm going to say Newcastle in general through the programme.
Can we boo him every time he does it?
But it would sound fake if I said Newcastle. Would it not?
No, I think... Does he sound fake when he does that?
So if you were... I mean, I repeat what I went to last week, OK? So if you were in West Sussex and you visited the very lovely Lancing College, L-A-N-C-I-N-G, you would say Lancing, wouldn't you? But the locals say Lancing. So on that logic, can I say Newcastle? No, probably not. OK. So what I would like to do is to find out if we have an announcer, because there are various features throughout the programme that we're going to need an announcer for. And we're going to do this because we've had a number of emails, like this from Chris Moore in Brighton. Hello, Mrs. Pringle and Rodney. I'm an avid podcast listener and have been for many years, but I'm alarmed to hear voiceover interjections 100 decibels louder than your collective sultry tones. Why, oh why, do I need reminding who I'm listening to and what it is? Unless your listeners are renowned for selective amnesia and cannot recall the current programme they've subscribed to, downloaded and are listening to without a sledgehammer of a radio bit to bring them back to reality. I'm also aware of where it is in the top 10 rundown by the fact that one, Simon, a veteran and well-loved radio presenter, announces
that's Simon Bates they're referring to.
And two... The ever-decreasing numbers. What else could it be? No need for a cacophony of whizzes and pips accompanied by a smoky siren exclaiming, "The box office top 10 with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo," to eardrum-bursting volume. So what we want is a smoky siren, please, from the northeast, someone with a mouth on them who would be prepared, to, just so that we can make our radio program sound just as noisy as the podcast. And I think just before we came on air, we spontaneously found a woman who was by the name of... Hello, can you just identify yourself for everyone?
Fiona.
Fiona who?
Fiona Birkbeck, but I'm afraid I've lost my northernness.
You right. Mislaid it, or, you know...
Where was it, then?
It's gone a bit nasal with the cold, so sorry.
OK. And can you shout? I mean, have you got a gob on you,
basically? Oh, I can shout.
Okay, can you say then, the box office top 10 with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo?
And can you say my name louder than his for once?
Go.
The box office
I'm sorry.
Much louder.
No. This is a pantomime. Okay, go.
The box office top 10 with Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode!
I like the sound of that.
Do you like that?
I do.
Chris continues, why not just employ Brian Blessed to stand in the studio and shout, films! Gordon's alive! No, I quite like that. Actually, could you come out, please, announcer? Because we've got a microphone here on the stage, and I've always fancied having our own announcer. We'll just do it for the first hour of the show, OK? And then we'll change announcers in the second hour.
Yeah, bring your chair.
Come on, Fiona. Fiona, we want you on the stage. Give a round of applause, please. Fiona, over here. Over on this side of the stage. Thank you very much indeed. And then every 10 minutes, when I point at you, if you could just say, films! Okay. If there's anything that we need announcing, that's the microphone there, Fiona. Okay. Excellent.
So it's like making somebody stand in the naughty corner. She came here early to get a nice seat, and now she has to stand for an hour.
Yeah, she's not by the microphone. Like, this is the microphone here, this big thing. Up on stage, Fiona. No, Fiona, come on, stand here. She's the shyest woman with the loudest voice. You can't do it from there. They won't pick it up. Roger Crowe from Howden in Yorkshire. This morning I had a chat with Phyllida Law, who's Emma Thompson's mum and wife of Magic Roundabout narrator Eric Thompson, about the impending release of
Duke and the Blue Cat coming out on DVD for the first time, long awaited.
Thought you'd like to hear her thoughts on The Good Doctor. Me. Mark Kermode is a big fan of Dougal and the Blue Cat. Do you know him at all? And has he been in touch about the movie? Phyllida.
No.
Mark. I don't know him at all, but I know the one you mean. He's the one with the amazing hair. There you go. That's what you've... Beach, the one with the flappy hands, I imagine. That's from Roger. Now, there's one other thing that we just need to tell you about. And do we need to reprise the Benjamin Snidlegrass story? Do you think people have remembered that?
It'd be worth recapping, just to be clear. Well, there was a while ago, I was reviewing a movie that was clearly a sort of Harry Potter ripoff, and I can't remember what the name of it was now. Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, thank you very much. And I said, it's so much like a Harry Potter movie, because it's a story of a kid who thinks he's an ordinary kid and has a boring life, and then somebody comes along and says, you're not an ordinary kid, actually you're magic. Hey, why don't you come along to this magic school where you can learn a bunch of magic stuff, and then all your friends are also magic and go on adventures together, and you know what, there might be a whole series of them. I think I have heard this somewhere before, and it's directed by Chris Columbus, or that bean-counting vending machine, as I like to call him. And I said in the review that they might as well have called it Benjamin Snidlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins. And it was just something we said in passing. And the next thing we know, Benjamin Snidlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins seems to have taken on a life of its own, and is, even as we speak, in production. No, I mean, really, really.
Jeremy Dillon, who is an aficionado of this programme, who lives in Australia, that's where he's doing it, and he sends this email. You can check this out online. Friends, Romans and countrymen, he likes the theatrics a little bit. It is a truly momentous day, for today we see the premiere of the teaser trailer for the most anticipated romantic fantasy horror psychological thriller sci-fi coming-of-age comedy drama Australia has seen in months, Benjamin Snidlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins, which now exists. Besatcop, as it's known, is the harrowing tale of a nerdy redhead from Cockfosters in the UK who discovers that he is part of an ancient order of Wittertainers. Under the watchful eye of Mr. Pentangle, Benjamin heads out to Australia to be taught the way of the Witter by eccentric Bavarian filmmaker Werner Herzog. But soon he discovers he must face unexpected challenges in the person of the sinister Lord Emmerich, a vicious mastermind with the head of a gorilla. Also, skiffle music, it's narrated by Stephen Fry, titled by Mark Kermode. And it genuinely is Stephen Fry saying Benjamin Snidlegrass.
It is, isn't it? I've seen the trailer, and I wonder whether it was somebody doing it, but it genuinely is Stephen Fry, isn't it? Because Stephen Fry went to Australia, and clearly your man there was waiting on the tarmac the minute he got off the plane, grabbed him and said, "Oi, would you mind just voicing this trailer?"
The teaser trailer is up, and you can look at it online. It's nothing to do with us. It's just Jeremy's work. But who knows? If it becomes successful, I think we are a part of it.
Yes. 5%. If it becomes successful, we claim credit. If it doesn't, we had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
So we're going to hear some questions from our fine audience here in Newcastle. We have a whole bunch of questions here. Is this kind of like a section in the programme that we're going to call Ask Mark a Question? Actually, Fiona, you can do that. Can you just say that?
Ask Mark a Question.
Okay, so Lee Rankin is going to be asking the first question. If you could put your hand up, please, and we'll get a microphone to you over there. Stage right. Hello, Lee. Where are you from?
From Northumberland.
Okay, thank you very much for coming over for our show today. Your first question...
Or if you're listening in the south, he's from Northumberland.
Why did you go camp? I should say, during the cricket update from Alison, Mark was modelling a Five Live sweatband.
Yeah, because there are these things on the desk, I can figure out what they are, and they are Five Live branded sweatbands. So when, yes.
It doubles up as a bandage if you have a wrist injury.
Yes. Anyway, sorry.
Yes, right, okay, Lee's question. Over you go.
I want to ask Mark, if Sex in the City 3 and Transformers 3 were released on the same day and you had to review them, would the resultant sort of heat and CO2 from the probably titanic Kermodian rant actually affect global warming in any way?
Okay, so but look, I mean, as a partly serious answer, quite genuinely, you have to, although I know nobody believes for one minute that I do, and it doesn't make any difference whether I say I do or not, you have to go into all of these things hoping for the best. There is a problem with any form of film criticism, which is that the minute you decide that things are wretched beyond belief, you know, you're sort of sunk. And there is... sometimes you're in screenings, you know, because National Press Show screenings, and you do sometimes look around you and you can see a kind of collective wave of people having judged something in advance. The fact of the matter is, there is always the possibility, right, that Transformers 3 will turn out to be a science fiction masterpiece to rival 2001, or that Sex and the City 3 will turn out... No, but you're laughing now. Yes, I understand the possibility is infinitesimally small, you know, in the same way that it's possible that Doctor Who may be true, or, you know, I mean, all. But if you don't go in hoping for the best... then you're kind of sunk. And if I was now looking ahead at... is Sex and the City 3 happening? I thought it wasn't happening because they said that Sex and the City 2 had unfired. I know that
who
Michael...
Who are you asking?
Well, the gentleman who asked the questions.
Well, why should he know?
Because he
you're
raised
the... critic.
Yeah, but he asked a question. I'm deferring to... Did you not watch Question Time last night? That's
that
how it
label,
worked.
That was the label.
I know. What
thing.
I love about it is how the trick, apparently, is using somebody's name in the answer to say, I'm looking about... I've already forgotten what the gentleman's name is.
I'm sorry. I'm not voting
Lee.
For you.
Lee. Well, Lee. Yeah, no. So you have to go in hoping for this. It is possible that Transformers 3 will turn out to be absolutely brilliant. I mean, they've got rid of Megan Fox, and they've now got in somebody else that Michael Bay met whilst making a lingerie commercial for Victoria's Secret. So, you know, make of that what you will. But who knows? But you always have to go in expecting the best. And it's the same, you know, with Sandra Bullock movies, for example. There was a point when we'd all sat through, you know, All About Steve and those sort of things. So is it possible for Sandra Bullock to make a good movie? But you know that she is good, and then she goes and does something that's perfectly decent, The Blind Side, and the next thing, you know, she's back on top form again. So I do genuinely go in with an open mind. That said, if I was a betting man, I don't have high expectations of either of them.
We got to the answer in the end. So next we have...
I was giving a full and thorough account of myself.
Thank you. Colin Robson's question is going to come next. Colin, where's Colin Robson? Gone to. He's over on the other side. Let me just mention this from Tim Brain, an email.
Tim Brain?
Tim Brain is his name. Simon and Mark, he says rather conservatively, listening to your podcast this week and the talk of melon farmer,
yes,
admittedly baffled me, but I've worked it out. I assume it's a reference to some kind of poor dub sub of the Samuel L. Jackson catchphrase, which indeed it is, Tim. Anyway, I still have in my possession a VHS tape of Die Hard 2, that I recorded off ITV back in the mid-90s, in which one of the more famous lines, as I think you'll probably remember, is when Bruce Willis says, yippee-ki-yay, and then...
Melon
and then,
farmer.
Yeah. But actually, on the ITV version, he says, yippee-ki-yay, monkey farmer. And that is the latest version.
As we came off air last week, there was a message from Anwar Brett, a very fine film journalist, saying, I've just been listening to the show, I know you won't get this until afterwards, but on the subject of where the melon farmer came from, there is a film in which Charles Bronson actually plays a melon farmer, which apparently is where it comes from. I can't remember what the film was, if anybody can remember. Oh, there we go, Mr. Majestic, there we go. In
I
which
told you,
Charles
it's the
Bronson
most informed
audience thing, is a melon farmer. So that's apparently where it comes from. He wasn't a monkey farmer, clearly. Is there a film in which Charles Bronson was a monkey farmer?
Colin Robson, where are you, Colin?
Hello.
Where are you from, sir?
South Shields.
Thanks very much, Steve, for coming to our little show. What is your question?
My question is, how often do you both go to the cinema together, and how irritating do you both find it?
Right, you go first, because I have a lot to say on this subject.
I don't know how you can. The answer is not very often, because he's the critic, and I'm not. Occasionally, we go to the same screening... together, but that would be, it's a very rare thing. In fact, the first time, I think, we
Ace Ventura, Pet Detective 2, When Nature Calls.
Exactly right. That was the film that I was trying to think of, and which is one of the worst films ever made, and we both almost walked out of it.
It was a grotesque experience, and I kind of blame Simon for it being as bad as it was, because it was worse than the first one. But what's happened since then is occasionally we go to screenings, and it is very occasionally we go and see a film together. And what I find really troublesome is that you have to be forced to turn your Twitter feed phone off. So literally, you'll be sitting there as the credits are going. You'll be going... I'm saying, Simon, turn your phone off. Yeah, the film hasn't started yet. Yes, the film has started. The credits have started. That is part of the film. All right, I'll just tweet. I'm just going to turn my tweet off because the film is like, stop doing the thing with the tweet. It's like sitting next to a fidgeting monkey with a computer. And it drives
fidgeting
me
monkey
nuts.
Farmer. And, of course, the great thing about going to see a film with Mark is that there has to be an empty seat in front, an empty seat behind, an empty seat to the right, and an empty seat to the left. Now, one of us has very strange behaviour, and obviously people will just decide which one is the strangest.
It's very simple. If somebody's sitting in front of you, their head can get in the way. If somebody's sitting beside you, they can, you know, nudge you and be different. If somebody's sitting behind you, they can do the thing which is the most annoying thing that anyone can do in a cinema, which is to kick the back of your chair. And I'm sorry, I do believe in hanging for people who kick the back of your chair in a cinema. There was a certain cinema chain in America that for a while brought in, you know, proper guards who, when, you know, you go to cinema, people talk, people use the phones, the rest of it, who were literal proper bodyguards who would physically throw you out of the cinema, and I applaud that sort of thing. I think there should be an armed response to kicking the back of somebody's chair.
So you need to buy 5 seats.
Yeah, when I asked if the ideal circumstances of watching There Will Be Blood, I figured you had to do 5 seats, your seat and the 4 diagonally around it, in order to fully experience the film properly.
So if this is one of the big 3D films, which I, you know, which obviously we'll get onto, but that's
about 60 quid.
That's a big night out in your house. We have a question from Steve Coyne coming next. You can email, Steve Coyne, if you could put your hand up, sir. That would be very good. mayo@bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. Steve, yes.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, with reference to the human centipede, do you think there's any point in films being made that are just there to push the boundaries of taste?
Well, and
remind us of the film.
Well, I have yet to see The Human Centipede. It's one of those. I think it's now coming out on video, and there was an awful lot of fuss about it when it's. I don't think I can actually repeat what the subject matter is in front. It's about somebody making a centipede out of people, right? You know, you can figure out the mechanics of this yourself. But I think, as always with those films, until you've actually seen them, you don't. You know, the idea of a film can sound far different to what the reality is. As far as pushing boundaries is concerned, there will always be films that deliberately go to be outre, deliberately try and, you know, step over the line. It's always a question of on what level they do it. And the clearest example of that is Antichrist recently, you know, the Lars von Trier film. When the Antichrist was described, it was a very different thing to actually watching the film itself. And when it was described, it just sounded like Lars von Trier going, oh, for heaven's sake, Lars, stop it. You know, you're just trying to think of what else you can possibly do to annoy the audience. But actually, when you see the film, it's a very different experience. So having not yet seen Human Centipede, I can't pass judgment on it. But I do think there are certain films which deliberately push boundaries, but more often than not, films are described in one way, but actually when you see the film itself, it doesn't turn out to be like that. And each case is... I don't think many filmmakers genuinely sit down and think, I'm just going to make a film to see how far I can go, because you won't get very far with it. John Carpenter said an interesting thing once on the subject of horror movies, and he was talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which many people thought of as doing exactly that, you know, just pushing the boundaries. And John Carpenter said, the thing with horror movies is what you have to do is take the audience right up to the edge of what they can stand, and then literally ride a kind of, you know, a razor blade along that edge. He said, the problem is if you go too far, you lose them, and you lose them badly, and that's the end of it all. And I think he was right. I think that thing about extreme cinema, the real knack of extreme cinema is knowing exactly where the boundary is. Just going over the top and just doing stuff to be taboo breaking and to be groundbreaking actually isn't very popular, is generally not very interesting, and generally won't find an audience.
Thanks for the question, Steve. The next question, we're going to have a fit in a quick question before the news from Paul Shackleton. So if Paul could make his presence known. You might like to know you can watch proceedings. We are being streamed live, and you can see Mark and I reclining in our Jimmy Savile's sort of... No, that's Danny Dyer.
Oh, sorry.
You have a Danny Dyer chair. I have a Jim Will Fix It kind of chair. The most extraordinarily uncomfortable chairs. So we have our next question. Paul, have we found Paul Shackleton? Let me put Paul's question. Oh, we've got him here. He's right down the front. Hello, Paul.
Guy with the microphone being held in front of his face. It's a bit of a giveaway.
You came to our show in Leeds.
I did.
You came to our show in Edinburgh.
Yes.
You came to our show in Hull.
Yes.
Are you following us around?
Yes.
Were you there when Mark opened his bathroom curtains this morning?
Not quite.
No. Okay. Your question.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering if you've ever watched a film, reviewed it, and thought at the time it was really, really good, and then maybe a few years later, down the line, watched it again, and then you thought it was complete pants.
I've certainly watched the film, reviewed it, and really hated it, which is Blue Velvet. When I first saw Blue Velvet, I walked out of it. I was really cross about it, and I walked out and I wrote this incredibly sanctimonious review about how...
No.
I know, shocking.
Sanctimonious review.
It was such a long time ago. And then, of course, you know, I did go back and see it years later and realise I was completely wrong. And actually, I think it's a masterpiece and it's extraordinary. Occasionally, what happens is, because people often say, if you're a film critic, when you watch movies, don't you find that you get bored and they all run into each other? Actually, completely the opposite happens. What happens is, if you've got a day of watching movies, you know, day after day after day, it's not that you get bored and they all tend to bleed into each other. What happens is you start to see things in them that possibly aren't there, because actually you want every, this relates back to the previous question, you want everything to be the best it possibly can. So certain, that often happens at festivals. I mean, if you're at a festival and you're doing like 40 screenings in a week and you're desperate to find something that's, you know, that's good, you will quite often find that critics will review films from festivals, say something's extraordinary and groundbreaking and what, and then actually when you see it in the cold light of day, you know, it's not, it's just fairly average. And I'm absolutely certain I've done that. But the biggest turnaround for me was in the case of Blue Velvet, which hit me completely the wrong way, and I really, really objected to it. And the thing that I learned from that was, if a film produces a really profound reaction, you know, it everything that's bad about it could also be good about it. I mean, it's possible, if it's a really good movie, you can love and hate at the same time. So that, I, you know, that I think is the clearest example for me. You must have seen things that you saw that you thought were great and then gone back afterwards and thought, actually, that isn't any good at all. You're always recommending comedies that aren't very funny. You're constantly saying, oh, I saw such and such the other day, it was brilliant, and it wasn't.
I've never said that in my life. You're just making stuff up to impress the audience. Like, when did I say that?
Well, you go on about how brilliant Amadeus is all the time. I mean, Amadeus is fine, but it's, you know, it's just fine.
No, if somebody says to me, what's your favourite film, I'll say Amadeus. Because it still is. If someone says to you, what's your favourite film, well, remarkably, it's still The Exorcist.
Yeah, but I've seen The Exorcist loads of times and it does stand up every time. I think if you went back and saw Amadeus, you might think it doesn't quite hit the mark. I mean, I just think you're wrong. That's all, you know. It's a
right.
Simple thing.
That's it. So that's where we
get to. And you know, if you saw Dougal and the Blue Cat in the new, soon-to-be-released DVD copy, available in both the English and French versions, with including amongst the extras commentary by, oh, me.
It would be less tedious.
I think you'll find that actually it's a very fine and surreal piece. Well, how many people here have seen Dougal and the Blue Cat?
That's five.
And of the five of you, keep your hands up if you think it's brilliant. All the hands still up. I win.
Right. Right, so you're the kind of person that's employed as an electioneer in those countries that are somewhat undemocratic. Who's won the election? I see 295 people haven't seen it, but the five who have, that means I win.
I like to think of it as a benevolent dictatorship.
The movie's coming up. There are some brand new movies. In fact, it's a very busy week.
It is.
You will hear the reviews for.
Well, we'll definitely do I'm Still Here. We'll definitely do Winter's Bone. We will try and do The Other Guys. Then there's F, La Horde, the horror movie. We'll try and get all of those out of the way, certainly. And then also after that, if we get through them, then there's Just Right and some other stuff as well.
We have a new stage announcer replacing Fiona, who had a splendid half hour as our show announcer, being replaced by Lee Rankin, who asked our first question. All right, Lee?
Yep, fine.
Yeah, okay. So, Lee, you just have to say something like, and now the questions continue.
And now the questions continue.
Now we Dear Five in the Big Brother house.
Very good. So, now that is a very patronising comment to make.
But got a laugh, so, yeah. You know.
So carry on. Keep going. We got an announcer because the podcast has an announcer, so we thought the real show should have an announcer, so Lee Rankin is going to be doing that. So let's get our next question. Gordon Smith, you're on, sir. Gordon, what's your question?
From Forest Hall near Newcastle.
All right, Gordon, thanks for
coming. My question is to Mark. Mark, is there anything that you don't have a strong opinion on?
Oh, good question.
You mean anything or any film?
Anything at all, because I know you too, or just how Simon says Newcastle, you're up there, so
yeah, no, I mean, I have no...
What about cabbage?
Yeah, no, I have no strong opinion about it. I have no strong opinion about sport at all, because I know absolutely nothing about it. The U2 issue is slightly different, because it's impossible to get away from U2. And also, because I have seen U2 play live, because one of my favourite bands ever, the Comsat Angels, the first time I ever came across U2, they were supporting the Comsat Angels, and I thought, gosh, that support band's really boring. The Comsat Angels are huge. In fact, this may actually underlie, and I'm realising this now, this may be at the root of everything. I'm quite apart from the fact that U2 are incredibly boring anyway. But it may be that they became the biggest band in the world and the Comsat Angels didn't even become the biggest band in Sheffield, which is a bit of a shame. But, you know, there's loads of things I don't
know. So your opinion on that is actually just motivated by peak rather than intelligence?
What, you mean as opposed to all the other things in which my opinion is not motivated by... Yeah. You know,
so there's actually no intellectual substance behind your opinion?
Well, about U2?
Yeah.
U2 are incredibly dull.
But that's because... They happen to be bigger than the Comsat Angels.
No, I'm saying that may have been the thing that makes me feel so strongly about how boring they are. So but just, they are boring.
But there are lots of things that you have no real opinion on.
Yeah, I mean, plenty of things. I mean, yes, I can't think of any of them at the moment, but I'm sure there are many things I don't have an opinion about. Think of something off the top of your head.
Oh, dear me. Alan Shearer.
Yeah, I have no opinion about Alan Shearer at all. Who is Alan Shearer?
He's a hero around here, I think, unless there's any Mackems in, but I doubt that.
Okay, I have no idea where the conversation is going now.
He was in this room last night, commanding a very large audience.
Well, there we go.
Almost as big as this one.
Yes.
He's a local legend.
Make films?
Yes, he makes films.
Oh, in that case, I love his work, particularly the early funny ones.
And here comes a question from Claire Murphy, who's right down here at the front. Hello, Claire, how are you?
Hi, Simon. I'm fine, thank you.
Where are you from?
I'm from Tynemouth.
Your question?
I'd like to ask Mark what, in his opinion, is the best film that's been made or set in Newcastle?
Well, that's interesting.
Sounds like a quiz question.
Well, it's funny. Funnily enough, although it's not in Newcastle, because it's up by... There's that film Strictly Belter, which has got all the Angel of the North stuff in it, which I think is flawed, but I do actually... I like that film. Stormy Mondays, I think, is really interesting, and it did something with the architecture and with the look, which is... But you kind of have to say Get Carter and the car park stuff, don't you? Isn't that... Yes, I'm getting the... But actually, just in that case, since you just put a thumbs up for that, I'm going to stick with Stormy Monday. No, but you've seen Stormy Mondays, right? I mean, it's an interesting...
But it's got Sting in it.
I know, and it all seems to come back to that, doesn't it? I think I've just got a bit of
a
Sting.
That's a bad thing, Claire, is it?
Yeah, it is, in my opinion. I might get killed now. But yeah.
Sting's adventures with a lute have certainly turned a lot of people against him.
But you decided to stay in your castle.
Because Sting told me to.
Yeah. So of all the reasons to stay in your castle, that's not a very...
My favourite Sting moment in cinema ever, and there aren't very many, is the moment in David Lynch's film Dune, in which Sting comes out of a steam shower wearing nothing but a pair of angel's wings over his particulars, which is just... I just wanted to be there in the script meeting when Sting read that scene and went, yep, I'm going to do that.
Is Sting a better actor than David Bowie?
David Bowie.
Did I ask you to do an impression?
No.
No, I didn't.
Most people are a better actor than David Bowie.
Is Sting a better actor?
No, he's not. Sting is a very poor actor, indeed.
But most people would be better.
Most people would be better than David Bowie, apart from Sting, yes. Should we move on? Why Sting and U2 are dominating this discussion?
Are there any other movies from Newcastle that we should have mentioned that didn't after Claire's question? And
Payroll. Yeah.
Well, don't just say yes.
Well, what else am I going to say? Yes, that's another film around here that's really good. I mean, I tell you,
Payroll, by the way, was the heckle.
I did genuinely mean it, that I think that there is that... You've all seen Purely Belter, right? All that stuff from when they're around the set. And I think that's a really lovely little film. And it wasn't very widely seen, but I thought it was a really good piece of work. And, of course, Mike Figgis is from here, isn't he? Or is he from... Yeah, he is, yeah. Can we do the best record that mentions anywhere nearby, which is that Mark Knopfler record, which talks about going to the Spanish City, and I went to Spanish City just because it comes up in Tunnel of Love. And it was a bit of a disappointment. Anyway, moving on.
Thanks very much indeed for that anecdote. That was particularly good. Fergal has the next question.
I was wondering if Mark and his band will be doing any film scores.
Where are you, Fergal? See you in a... I've been accompanying silent films quite a lot recently. We're just up in Shetland and we did an accompaniment to White Oak. But there's this film... The Dodge Brothers. The greats... There's a skiffle band that I play in, as you obviously know, called the Dodge Brothers. And we started getting interested in doing silent film accompaniment because I think it's a really interesting area. And there's this Louise Brooks film called Beggars of Life, which is just a terrific Louise Brooks movie. And the story of it is really, really strange. At the beginning of the movie, Louise Brooks is in this house and it turns out she's killed this guy, and a drifter turns up to ask for some food, realises that Louise Brooks has killed this guy, says, you better come on the run with me, but you know what, you're going to have to dress up as a bloke so nobody knows. So Louise Brooks dresses up as a bloke, at which point she looks even better than she looked when dressed as a woman. And then they go on this kind of hobo train together and they meet people like Wallace Beery. Wallace Beery actually turns up carrying a canister of beer. I mean, it's just like, he's Wallace Beery, he's carrying cannons. Anyway, so we started doing some accompaniments with that, with a guy called Neil Brand, who's a silent movie pianist. And in fact, this Sunday, we're doing it in Cambridge, where I believe people are waiting, even as we speak, to lynch me because of our row about Cambridge being the best university in the whole world last week.
Well, only because you went off on one of your bizarre, well, you just childish rant.
Cambridge is lovely, but you can't say that Cambridge is the best university in the world. It's a silly thing to say.
Well, so 15,000 academics did, of course.
Yeah, moving swiftly on. So we're doing that on Sunday. And then on Friday, a week today, in the New Forest, as part of this thing that I'm running, the New Forest Festival, we're doing it in the New Forest in Brockenhurst with the projector being powered by bicycles. So we're trying to, no, seriously, because we're trying
is
to do
is this a planted question, by the way?
I don't know the guy, but I was really pleased that he asked.
Oh, do you happen to be doing any gigs with movies attached? Just check the next question. Are there any skiffle bands you'd recommend, Mark?
Is your book coming out in paperback soon?
We are just underneath the disco balls in the Banqueting and Conference Hall at Newcastle's Centre for Life with a fine audience of 300... How many do you think? 350? 400?
I think about 1,000.
500. You ask the organisers, 600. Ask the police, 250. That's usually the way it goes. Liz from Ponteland has got the next question. Down here, three rows from the back. Right. Just get a microphone to you. Do you want to stand up, Liz, so everyone can see where you are?
Can I just say Liz is not three rows from the back. She's clearly three rows from the front.
Sorry, that could confuse a stupid person.
The front is the one nearest to you.
And you can watch this, of course, if you want to see just how inaccurate that statement was. All being live-streamed. Liz, don't let that put you off. It's nice to have you here. What is your question?
Right, hi. I'd just like to know if there was anything that would make you go and see that lovely Transformers film with Megan Fox in it again, because I was listening to you review it when I was driving home from work and you were on such a rant I nearly had to pull the car over because I was laughing so much.
What would make you go and see it again?
I mean, the terrible thing is I have seen it twice. I mean, I have. Because
what made you see it a second time?
Because I went to see it once at the National Press Show, which is where I saw it first, which is when they get to show it to the press. And then I have a family member who wanted to go and see it, so I had to take him to go and see it.
Could you not... you're the father and the critic. Could you not just go, well, son, let me tell you, and then explain why this was going to be an inappropriate film?
You're assuming that the family member was my son. It might be my dad, who wanted to see Transformers 2. No, because I have a... I don't... No, because you can't tell people what they can and can't see, can you?
I beg your pardon?
You can't... No.
I beg your pardon? You spend your life doing that.
Okay, let me rephrase that. It's not, you can't tell them what they can and can't see. You can tell them what they should and shouldn't see. But when you're actually... No, that is different, right? If you're actually in control... If you are the person who takes the person who asks to the cinema and they say, this is what I want to see, you can't say, I'm sorry, son, you can't see that Birth of a Nation showing somewhere else. We're going to see that instead. You can't do that. What you can do is say, here are the reasons why you shouldn't go and see it. You know what it's like. You can't tell your kids anything. My daughter, very quickly, went on an aeroplane trip recently, and I'm not making this up, she sat on the aeroplane, she watched Bride Wars 6 times. It was a transatlantic flight. 6 times, laughing like a drain, right? And at the end of the 6th time, she turned to me with a look of total contempt and went, you know nothing.
Top work. I think you brought them up to be liberal, free-spirited people.
Thank you.
Good quote, though. Very, very good quote. Next question comes from Adrian Hand. Adrian, if you could stand up. 85058, by the way, you can get involved. You can email us, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Adrian is right down at the front here and has a question for our live show here tonight, this afternoon in Newcastle. Yes, sir.
How are you both doing? You all right?
Good, thank you.
Is that the question?
He's the first person to have asked that. You see, now be nice to him.
Yep, we're both fine. Thank you very much indeed. Are you okay?
I'm good, thank you.
Can we get you a drink or anything?
Go on down there.
Okay, excellent.
Question is quite straightforward. One of your favourite things to say is that we're all entitled to our opinions, but they are, in fact, wrong. Well, so I wondered whether or not you actually would genuinely assert that there is a universal truth to film criticism, that I am right and you are wrong, and that is just the way it is.
Good question.
Okay, so I think that the answer to that is this. All film criticism is subjective, and the idea that you can write a review that isn't subjective is nonsense, okay? Because everybody's response to every film is completely subjective, which is why I think that when you do film criticism, it has to be personal criticism. So, you know, you can contextualise the film, say this is where it came from, these are the other films it refers to, these are the things that you should know about it. Contextually, those are absolutes, and then your opinion of it, which is entirely subjective. That is what it is. It's just that my subjectivity happens to be right. Now, Other opinions are clearly available, but there is the thing that I can't be doing with is that thing which says, well, you know, if you like this, then you like this, and da 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 da. Because actually, if you feel strongly about anything, anybody who has a strong opinion about it believes at the moment that they hold that opinion is right. And you know, you could say to me, for example, you've seen the Transformers movies, and you think they're absolutely. Have you seen the Transformers films?
Seen the second one, partially.
You know, partially? Mm-hmm. How did you watch? Oh, you mean you only saw a bit of it?
I actually slept.
Oh, okay, you slept. With, it's a weird thing with Transformers. It's so loud it becomes silent. You actually stop watching. You know, afterward it comes with like white noise. But, you know, people are able to argue that that film is actually a brilliant piece of work. Interestingly enough, one of the things that I often have to do as a film critic is explain to people who think they've enjoyed films why they haven't. And it is something I take particular pride in doing. But so, no, of course, all reviews are completely subjective. My subjectivity just happens to be right.
Thank you very much.
Good, classic question. Thank you very much indeed. Next one from Dr. Marie Johnson from Whitley Bay. Where's Dr. Marie? Right in front of us, seven rows from the front, I believe. Marie, very nice to have you here. What is your question?
Thank you. 20 years ago, I had a newborn son, and I was absolutely exhausted, as you are. What kept me sane was a great classic called Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
It's a round of applause.
I just wonder if you have a similarly therapeutic film in your life that's served you well.
Yeah, Dougal and the Blue Cat has served me brilliantly.
Okay,
all
well,
the way.
Apart
the only,
from that.
No, the, what you say apart from that, the only bad experience I've had with Dougal and the Blue Cat, when I saw Dougal and the Blue Cat when I was really young, when I was, you know, six or seven or something like that, and then I was bought the soundtrack album for it, which I think an awful lot of people had. It was an MFP soundtrack album, which had the whole film, you know, the story of the whole film with Eric Thompson doing the voice. And I listened to that over and over again. And so I literally, quite literally, not metaphorically, literally know the whole film off by heart. And I have never, ever had a bad experience watching that film, except one time, which is when I left Radio 1 and they showed it as my leaving film and I sat next to him and he cast a cloud of gloom and despondency over the entire experience.
I think it's made for drug addicts.
I'd just like to say, in a personal and legal sense, I distance myself entirely from that comment.
I just said it gives the opinion that if you're completely on another planet, you might just enjoy it. For everyone else, I just go, good grief, this is dull.
You do really need to see it again. It's brilliant. It's a great surreal piece. And I mean, other examples would be Mary Poppins, which I have watched time and time again and never ever let me down. Silent Running, the Doug Trumbull movie, science fiction film, which is just fantastic. Matter of Life and Death, every time you see it, everything just flies away and you just, you know, swept up in that film. I mean, those have never failed. And I mean, It's a Wonderful Life. I've never seen It's a Wonderful Life and not burst into floods of tears. And I defy anybody to watch that film and not be totally bowled over by it. But Mary Poppins, I mean, you could put Mary Poppins on a loop again and again and again. Every time you see it, there's something in it you hadn't seen before. Have you seen Mary Poppins?
Many times, but have you seen Killer Clowns from Outer Space?
Not that I have any abiding memory of, but interestingly, over here, there, it got a cheer.
Right. Can you summarise, I mean, what happens? Apart from, you know,
classic,
it's got
small American town, a spaceship comes down, disgorges clowns
from outer
who
space.
Kidnap the population, wrap them up in cotton candy, candy floss, cocoons, and then drink their lifeblood from bendy straws.
What was it in your completely tired state when you were a new mum, what was it about that film that provided you with comfort?
I think that was the intellectual level I was at, getting up five times a night.
Yeah. Is anyone famous in it?
Don't think so.
No, but it'll be like one of those things like Killer Tomatoes, which has got an early George Clooney thing, performance in it, or the Troma films, in which, I mean, the problem with those films is, and I can't refer specifically to the film you're talking about, there is a whole genre of films which were made in which the everything is in the title. So like Surf Nazis Must Die, which is a funny title but not a very funny film. You know, Teenage Nymphoid Barbarian in Dinosaur Hell, which is, again, all the humour in it is in the title. You watch the actual film, it's incredibly boring. The best one of those is Piranha Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, which is actually a really brilliant film, which is written and directed by a guy called J.D. Athens, who later turned out to be the guy who wrote the original script for Pretty Woman, writing under a pseudonym. And over here, it was called Piranha Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death because it was originally called Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, and the BBFC made them take the word cannibal out of the title because they didn't like movies with cannibal in them.
Anyway, got a round of applause.
So Killer Clowns from Outer Space, quick review?
Who was it who gave it the round of applause?
It is what the title says. It's Killer Clowns.
Just like the lady described.
And they're from outer space. Mm-hmm. There we go.
Do you remember that horror movie that got renamed, this is sort of back to the early 90s for reasons that will become obvious, which changed its name to One Wedding and a Lot of Funerals?
Yeah, that was originally Leprechaun 2, I think.
Which do you think works better?
Leprechaun 2.
So let's try and squeeze in another question here. Simon Lang. We would like a question from you, please. Oh, there you go. Right down on the front where we were many moments ago. Simon, you're on.
I think we're living in a golden age of television at the moment. I think it's amazing. And where cinema's perhaps lacking in a narrative sense, television's really kind of leading the way. There's so many amazing TV shows around at the moment. How has your thinking on television evolved recently?
Well, I mean, I watch very little television. I did a thing for The Observer a while ago, in which, I mean, I actually stopped watching television completely for a while, and on the belief that cinema good, television bad. And then we had Harry Shearer came on the show. And you remember this?
What?
And the radio show that you and I do together, yeah, on a Friday afternoon.
Sorry, what? I just...
Are you here? Are you... Okay. And Harry Shearer came on the show, who does the, you know, several voices, including voiced in The Simpsons. And
yes, that's right.
Yeah, you remember Harry Shearer.
I do.
And I said, oh, cinema good, something bad. And he said, right, so what you're saying is that the new Die Hard film is actually better than The Simpsons. And I realised that it was a really stupid thing to say. And
The Simpsons had been on about 10 years before you'd even
seen it. No, I've only seen it recently. I've only seen it since The Simpsons movie came out, which really made me laugh. And then somebody said, you know, there's a television show attached. Said, is there?
So you're really? In fact, you're uniquely unqualified to answer this question about
Golden
Age television.
Yeah, but I was doing a great job of flanneling. I loved Life on Mars, but that was a few years ago. I think that was the most recent thing I saw. What about you? You do television.
Well, a few years ago. But everyone here knows that radio is king. Everyone and queen. Everyone knows that radio works better because more intelligent people are involved. I mean, look at this crowd here. If proof were needed, this is the proof.
Yeah, it is. It
intelligence is in
radio. It was demonstrably the case a couple of summers ago, and it was the summer of threequels, that television was better than cinema. I still don't watch very much television. I just can't get my hat on about it.
The box office top 10 with Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode!
Okay, so we'll give you the box office top 10. We'll get to the reviews as well because it's a busy week of movie releases. We have some emails. Thank you for sending those. We also have a line of people who want to pronounce on assorted movies. The Expendables at number 10.
Which is, there's two films that are in the top 10 which I still haven't seen because they were out the month that we were off, which are The Expendables and Grown Up. So we start with The Expendables.
You're really not missing out, Mark. It was. It's old, it's tired, it made me feel very sad, it made me feel elderly beyond my years, and it was just so loud, very poor.
That'd be great to go on the poster, wouldn't it? Will make you feel elderly beyond your years.
Sandy in County Tyrone, mildly enjoyable nonsense, at least the geriatric Stallone didn't get off with the hot woman. Great gory violence, terrible script, not as bad as being made out. Number 9 is Dinner for Schmucks,
which was just, I mean, incredibly boring and really... I mean, actually, I think is shaping up to be my least favourite film of the year so far. Remake of a French film. You know, the idea is that these people get together and get schmucks over to laugh at them. Every joke that's in it that is even vaguely serviceable is in the trailer. It's one of those things, it just looks terribly smug. It's like a bunch of clever dick comedians got together and said, let's remake this French film. And, you know, in the end, the joke is on the audience because it's not funny and you feel like you're the schmuck for going.
No one in our audience is prepared to admit that they've been,
though
earlier...
We did not find anyone who's been.
Though, no, we did. Earlier when we asked, there were hands up, but no one is prepared to go on national radio and say... Mark in Earlsfield. Simon, last week I strayed from the good doctor's guidance and went to see Dinner for Schmucks. I thought, can't be that bad, not with that cast. So I took the kids, as I thought they might enjoy it. As you have rightly preached in the past, a comedy should have at least 5 laughs to qualify. Is it possible to have minus laughs? This is where you, yourself, can see the punchline coming and your own version is funnier than the one presented to you. If in your scriptures this does exist, then this terrible film has got minus 5 laughs. I beg of your forgiveness for not believing you and to remind me of your worth I have been birching myself with a copy of the Radio Times since sinning, and I will continue to punish myself by fasting at the cinema over the next 2 weeks, denying myself popcorn and a fizzy drink. I am indeed, says Mark, thoroughly ashamed.
But you know
myself.
What would be good, actually, to go and see the film with Mark and get him to stand up at the five appropriate moments and do his better punchline. Just stand up in the cinema and shout the funnier joke.
They used to do that with the Pierce Brosnan James Bond films. You used to, right, there's a big scene, it happens to be in a newspaper printing press, and you thought it's going to be black and white and red all over, or it's going to be a pun like that, and people were working them out, and when you got to them, yours were always better than the one that was actually in the script. The idea of minus laughs is a top idea. Thank you, Mark. You have redeemed yourself. If you've experienced minus laughter in a film, get in touch. mayo@bbc.co.uk. Next is Cyrus at number 8.
Which was I actually kind of rather liked. I think the problem that they have is that the way it's being sold by the poster makes it look much more like a frat boy comedy than it is, because of Jonah Hill's presence, and because actually the poster, although I think the poster has subsequently been changed, the original poster had a rather bawdy and unrepeatable tagline. In fact, it's kind of cute, because actually it's about two people attempting to have a relationship which is being scuppered by the child of the woman, who's played by Marisa Tomei. And actually, it's got that kind of indie mumblecore feel about it, which is, you know, it is technically a cross between an indie mumblecore movie and a frat boy comedy.
Can you define mumblecore?
We did this last week. You said, what's mumblecore? It's a film in which... You know, it's a film in which when people have conversations, the conversations go, you want to... Hey, yeah, I don't know. You get that thing with... like that?
Yes, what's your name?
Ray.
Ray? Ray, very good to have you on the stage here. What did you think of Cyrus?
I thought it was really good. I love mumblecore, and it was interesting and funny as well.
Can I just say, you see the way that she said, I love mumblecore, like Granddad over here is the one who doesn't know.
what are the other great mumblecore films I should be catching up with?
I don't know. I can't think now, but it's just stuff that's like really improv and just... Yeah, like he said, really. So.
Yeah, like he said.
Like he said, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much indeed.
I'm down with the kids.
Going the Distance at number 7.
Which I kind of enjoyed. And I was, as I said, I went to see it, and it was nice. It's, you know, the Drew Barrymore movie in which basically there's a guy and a girl, and they start having a relationship, but then she's going to live on the other side of America, and can they go the distance? Can the relationship work at long distance? And as is now the way with romantic comedies, it's a lot kind of harsher edged in its dialogue than romantic comedies used to be. But it's kind of cute and kind of funny and sweet, and I was very pleased that having enjoyed it and come out of the screening, which there was a bunch of national press critics there who all seemed to universally dislike it. And then I came out afterwards and saw there was a poster for the movie with a quote from James King, you know, James King from Radio 1, which had loved it, James King, Radio 1. I thought, oh, great, I am down with the kids. In an ironic kind of way. You've got nobody standing up to defend Going the Distance,
either. He's also 36.
He's not. James is 14.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World is at number 6.
Am I allowed to do this now? Because like, we kept getting mail from people saying, how come you haven't seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World? Because it came out to the time that I was off. And so I finally went to see Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And when I came out of it, I tweeted three words. I tweeted Howard the Duck. And there was this sort of people saying, well, oh, no, it can't possibly be as bad as Howard the Duck. You know, how can you possibly say that? Because it's an interesting thing with Scott Pilgrim, which is the Edgar Wright movie. And it cost quite a lot of money. And it had a very hard time in America finding an audience. I went to see it in Southampton, where I have to say the cinema was half empty. I like Howard the Duck. You see, Howard the Duck is often referred to as one of the great flops. There was a couple of people nodding their heads. You see, it's not just me. So are you nodding your head about Howard the Duck, right? Yeah, there we go, fine. So Howard the Duck is an interesting case for somebody doing a comic book. It totally tanked. Everybody remembers it as being, you know, a really, really terrible film. But actually, I really enjoyed it, and I laughed all the way through. And the more other people didn't enjoy it, the funnier I thought it was. In the case of Scott Pilgrim, I saw it in a screening room. There weren't that many people there. But I really... In fact, funnily, I've just done a blog about how Scott Pilgrim is basically Howard the Duck. I like it. I like it in the way that I like Howard the Duck, which I understand means that it's not going to hit a mainstream audience, and it clearly has failed to find that mainstream audience. But it is funny.
Yes, sir. What's your name?
John.
Where are you from, John?
I'm from Northumberland.
Okay, and what do you think of Scott Pilgrim?
I agree it was enjoyable, but I just felt it spent way too much money on it, and if it had done as like a low-budget film, yep, it would have been better. And it was very much like the Road adaptation recently that I just felt it was superfluous. That, like, if the source material is that good, why do you need to make a film out of it in the first place?
Okay, we're going to have a fight now. you're completely right in your observation about Scott Pilgrim. Absolutely. If it had been made for a lower budget, they weren't able to have those big fight sequences. It would have made it much tighter, yeah, and a better movie. Although, in the same way as Howard the Duck, I kind of enjoy the fact that in the case of Howard the Duck, they spent £2 million on the duck suit. And then everyone said afterwards, it looks like a bloke in a duck suit. You go, yeah, it's Howard the Duck. What do you expect? As far as The Road is concerned, The Road is a brilliant piece of filmmaking.
I really enjoyed it, but The Road is one of my favourite books, and I just felt that it missed out some of the what I got from the book anyway.
Yeah, then go back and see the film again, because clearly you missed the significant
part. Keep going to see it until you agree.
Until you agree, yes.
Carl and Luing on this email. I'm a big fan of Edgar Wright, so as you expected, was very excited to watch Scott Pilgrim. However, after 1 hour and 53 minutes, I left the cinema with
way
a bad
long.
Headache.
Yes, way too
and
long.
More confused than after watching Inception. I think I'm the only person in the world not to like it. The film's demographic is quirky, gaming, comic-reading 20-year-olds. I'm a 20-year-old gaming, comic-reading and quirky lover. What is wrong with me? When my friend asked if I'd liked it, I lied in daylight and said yes, just to be cool. Is this what the critics have been doing?
No, I mean, it hasn't received very, it hasn't got very good notices, and it certainly hasn't drawn very big audiences. But I think there is no question that it is all over the place, and it should be shorter and it should be tighter. But actually, the things that are wrong with it, oddly, I found charming in the same way that I laughed all the way through Hudson Hawk, and then I interviewed Richard E. Grant, and I said I enjoyed Hudson Hawk, and he said, "Well, you're an idiot, and you don't know what you're talking about." And he was in.
Another voice on Scott Pilgrim. Who are you, sir?
Hi.
Who are you?
Tom Jackson.
Hello, Tom Jackson.
Hello.
Wearing a very nice Harrington.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I thought Scott Pilgrim tried really hard to be cool. I thought Edgar Wright was like, look, we really know youth and stuff, and like, it's really cool to play retro video games. It's really cool to for women to dress up like men. And I just thought it was kind of like, you know, hammering the point home a bit.
How old are you, sir?
18.
Appreciate you coming down. Thank you.
No problem.
if he said 26, you would have said you didn't appreciate him coming down. I mean, the funny thing is that
it's just interesting, just painting pictures with words.
It's just the way you said it. How old are you? 18. We appreciate you coming down. It's like we appreciate the fact that you're 18, not the fact that you just said a very sensible point about Scott Pilgrim versus the world. Thank you very much. And incidentally, I like you, Harrington.
Cheers.
Sorry about that.
Awesome.
Right.
Tomorrow Drew at 5.
Well, I seem to be the person who doesn't like Tomorrow Drew and everybody else thinks it's the funniest thing ever. I mean, I saw it in Cannes. I thought it was, you know, again, it was all over the place. It didn't know whether it wanted to be a comedy. It didn't know whether it wanted to be a social satire. I did feel it was terribly smug. There are things in it individually that are great. I think Roger Allen's performance is great. I think there are individual things in it that I understand as being good. But I think when put together as a whole, it's terribly ill-disciplined, and it looks like something that was discovered in the editing. It's like they're putting all the stuff together and what is it? Oh, I know, it's a comedy. And I am genuinely baffled that it has been received as well as it has.
Yes, sir, what's your name?
Andrew.
How old are you?
I'm 28.
I'm glad you came down.
Thank you.
See? What do you think of Tomorrow, Drew?
I thought the characters were really obtuse, and I think they were really difficult to feel any empathy towards, and the humour wasn't really grounded in anything, and I thought it was absolutely kind of pretentious and just awful.
Thanks very much. Say what you think. And in France, on this email, sometimes I disagree with Mark, and writing this out is probably more sensible than shouting at the radio like I normally do. As a girly, I need emotional engagement in the film much more than any of the other stuff. First off, I have at least to give a monkeys about the man, woman, diminutive, pixelized robot or plasticine sheep on the screen and to relate to what's happening in their woolly or metal heads. Isn't that what drama is? I'm worried that people like me might go and see Certified Copy after you said it was less pointless on second viewing. I saw it some weeks ago and nearly died in my seat from boredom. I would have left early, but the woman on the end of our aisle had fallen deeply asleep. It's always the other end. As for Tamara Drew, where you found the lack of proper plot structure and social angle disappointing, in a film so warm and heartily entertaining, does it really matter that much if you're simply enjoying it and not trying to write an essay about it? Sometimes, says Anne, I think you prefer blokey films to ultra-girly ones, as many people do, women included. I watched Inception after your recommendation, found it boring and pointless. As a woman...
What?
As a woman, says Anne in France, as a woman, if I wanted to plant an idea in the mind of a man, I'd simply suggest whatever it was and then wait half an hour for him to start believing it was his own idea all along. Job done. No need for all that complexity nonsense. I only managed to stay conscious by making an effort to follow the plot twists, with a bit like listening to an 11-year-old saying, and then, and then, and then. I'm worried if I lose my confidence in your ability to fully appreciate girly-type stuff, I might end up ignoring your advice and seeing something like Sex and the City 2. Do you understand girly films?
Well, I think so, but no, I mean, clearly that's a very well-argued point, and yes, other opinions are available.
I think we should just
but
get
tomorrow's
Lee.
Tomorrow's isn't as good as everyone thinks.
We should just get Lee, our announcer, to tell people at home that the travel news and cricket update will be along in a minute.
And coming up, the travel news with Orna Merchant and a cricket update.
Yeah, but hang on a bit, because we've just got to finish the top ten, so thanks very much, Dean. The Last Exorcism is at number four.
60 minutes of a good horror film, 15 minutes of a completely rubbish remake of Devil's Reign. Totally loses everything in the last movement.
Yes, so your name?
Hi, I'm Mark.
I won't ask you how old you are or where you're from, but what do you think?
Okay, that's fine. It is one of those things where I agree would say there are films that are less hopeless on the second viewing, because I like the rest of it enough. Like before the ending,
yeah.
That I went to go back and see it a second time.
Yeah.
The first time I saw the ending, I was angry. I wanted to shout at the screen and just say, "What have you done?" You know, it's just. And then when I went to see it again, I didn't find it scary because I'd seen it all before. But I did think it was good. I liked the performances. I thought it was very well judged. But I didn't think the ending was anything out of the ordinary, like what was already discussed. So it's a good horror film, but it's not a scary one to me.
I just want to say, he's called Mark. He wears glasses. He's intelligent, and he wanted to shout at the screen at the end of a horror film. I'm sorry.
We can never meet again.
Quiffless.
I'll never forget our time together.
Such a tart. Ollie in Bournemouth, just thought I'd warn everyone planning to see The Last Exorcism that they should leave the cinema as soon as the young chap in the diner admits he's gay.
Yes, exactly, that's right.
I totally agree with Mark about the ending, so I think leaving at this point spares the crushing disappointment of the film's baffling and somewhat pointless denouement. Grown Ups at number three.
And
I
that
apologize
was the other one, so no idea. So, on to.
Anyone on Grown Ups? No, well, we can move on then. Toy Story 3 at 2.
Better in 2D.
Excuse me.
I mean, it's great, but it's better in 2D.
Yes, madam.
Yeah, it is better than 2, and I really enjoyed it. And also, Inception is not boring. It's amazing. I loved it. The end, what?
Basically. So, the ending, what?
I'm a girl, and I loved it. It was
You're
one of my
a girl, and you loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. And nah, I don't like romantic comedies or anything, so. I'm very a very good. Anti-girl, aren't I?
No, but no, yeah. You know, it's just you're right. He was just being ridiculously stereotypical.
But yeah, Toy Story 3 was really good, and I thought, I just hope they don't make a Toy Story 4 because it would just be pointless, and all my tears would have been there for nothing. Really, that's it.
Thank you.
Final Can I just word. Say, what you haven't pointed out is that, what's your name?
Sam France.
He's wearing a book. He's wearing a T-shirt. He's wearing a T-shirt which says movies ruining the book since 1920.
I'm that awesome, so, yeah.
Second awesome in 10 minutes, how about that? Number one, the box office number one. Actually, no, sorry, we need to get Lee to do this. Big one, big noisy one for the number one movie.
And the number one movie in the UK currently is?
Resident Evil Afterlife.
3D schmeedy. I mean, I just. The whole 3D thing is going down the toilet. Give it 2 years, it's going to be consigned to the dustbin of history. Resident Evil Afterlife is evidence of why Paul W.S. Anderson used to make films like Event Horizon. I mean, this isn't the worst of the Resident Evil films. It's just a perfectly, you know, functional franchise thriller spin-off from a game. But it is a very good demonstration of what's wrong with 3D, in that everything is wrong with 3D.
Richard Purvis on Paul W.S. Anderson. The man hasn't a cinematic bone in his body.
Not true. Event Horizon is cinematic.
Event Horizon, he continues, was a good-looking but overblown mess of a film that didn't know the genre it was supposed to be.
Oh, it did?
Since then, it didn't, says Richard.
Maybe it did.
It really didn't, said
really
Richard.
Really did.
No, it didn't. Since then, we've had a succession of video game thrills that have been dreadful in ways that compare to the drivel churned out by Uwe Boll. My point exactly. The Good Doctor is correct in saying that video games do not make good films. And as a filmmaker myself, said Richard Purvis, I heartily agree. They're badly thought out, badly plotted, dreadful dialogue. It's pretty fair to say that the only reason he gets Mila Jovovich to star in his films is because he's married to her. Is that true?
I don't know. Don't look at me. Is that something that's happening in the real world as opposed to on films?
The man should not be allowed near a film set ever again, and after the flop that was Soldier, I'm amazed that he still is. That is the box office top ten. What is our first new movie to be reviewed?
If we're going to do it before 5:30, because I want to have time to do I'm Still Here, I think we will start with doing The Other Guys.
This is Five Live. We're live in Newcastle, and Tom Frew on this email says, Mumblecore, which we were discussing Mumblecore. Merely moments ago, simply must be the name of the headmaster of the magical school in Benjamin's Nittlegrass. That kind of works, doesn't it? Tom also concludes,
why don't you spoil it now by telling everybody that he dies in the fifth book?
That was a terrible thing to say. a really, really terrible thing to say. There are some people reading that book now.
What, Benjamin Smith and Snittlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins? No, Simon, it's not real. It doesn't matter how many times you say it, how many Australian filmmakers, it's just made up.
Tom Frew concludes his email, Simon should stand firm on his original and correct pronunciation of Newcastle. I'm just reading out the email.
Yeah, why don't you try Mumblecore?
This is from Tom in Brighton. If Jason Isaacs is listening, would you like to say hello to Jason Isaacs? Because he will be listening.
Hello. No, can we not just hello? Can you say hello to Jason Isaacs? Otherwise, he doesn't know it's him. And
hello. Very good. He'll be listening somewhere on a podcast or listening live, baby, and answering back. That's the great thing. He said, if Jason Isaacs is listening, could you ask him if he knows where his nephew David is? We, his housemates, are expecting him back, and it's his night to cook. So there you go. That's a public service broadcast.
Can we do a film review?
Okay, yes. Lee, do you want to announce this?
And now, the film reviews.
Okay, so we'll do, since we've got to get this quickly out of the way before the news at half past. So The Other Guys, which is a big release of the week, with Will Ferrell and Marky Mark Wahlberg. Story is they are the other guys, whilst Sam Jackson and Dwayne The Rock are the exciting cops who do all the action-packed stuff and, you know, get all the girls and all the adulation. They are two pen-pushed at the beginning of the movie. The two heroes die, leaving the other guys to be the people who have to step into the spotlight. They then step into the spotlight, attempting to involve, unravel some bizarrely complex corporate crime plot, which features Steve Coogan as Steve Coogan, as far as I can tell. Here's a clip.
You know what bugs me about you?
What?
I'm pretty sure you've never voted.
No, I vote. Sports radio, AM 880, play of the week.
You're like a child in a leather jacket. That's what you're like.
Get out of the way, man.
Wait, are you David Urshan?
Yeah, well, it's Sir David Urshan, but I don't bother with you yet. So anyway, a little bit of a rush, gentlemen, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Excuse me, but you're under arrest, okay?
What?
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you do or say can be used, what's the next part?
As a flotation device.
As a flotation device. Oh, you know what? That's very funny. I have never Miranda'd anyone before.
Really?
Are you guys for real? Am I being punked?
You see, the weird thing is that as a flotation device gag got a big laugh here in the auditorium, or in the banqueting hall, as I think we're meant to refer to it. It's a strange schizophrenic movie. On the one hand, everything about it that works is the double act between Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. And I have to say, I'm not somebody who finds Will Ferrell very funny. And the more I watched it, the more I thought, actually, the real comic talent in this film is Mark Wahlberg. Mark Wahlberg is not only a very good actor, but a very good comedian. In that thing, Date Night, recently, he was the one consistently funny part. They keep having to go back to his apartment where he's in various states of undress. And he's very good at doing straight-faced comedy. In fact, even in the Scorsese film, The Departed, he's kind of scary funny. And I think it's interesting that he doesn't get enough recognition for what it is that he does. I think, actually, he's the funny part of the film, as opposed to Steve Coogan and Will Ferrell. The other part of the film is that there is, in theory, this thriller plot, which seems to be completely incidental. It's that Steve Coogan is up to no good, and they, being the other guys, being the desk man guys who are now out actually on the beat, have to go and somehow unravel this plot. And you think, well, it's completely irrelevant. The plot doesn't matter at all. It's simply what's happening is we're just being given circumstances in which they can be together in a car, in which they can be together in an office, in which they can be together in a warehouse, and they can do that scrabbling around, you know, bitching at each other thing, which is what they were doing. However, at the very end of the film, the closing credits, it's like they were directed by Michael Moore. The last 3 minutes of the film over the closing credits is this really strange sort of political series of graphs about how corporate America has actually made money, you know, crookedly. And it turns into this, so it makes you think, hang about a minute. The seriousness with which the closing credits are delivered seems to suggest that we were actually meant to be paying more attention to the plot during the film itself, and I wasn't paying any attention to the plot because the plot seemed completely perfunctory and to serve no purpose other than to put these two guys into situations together where they could bicker. The other thing is that there is a running gag about the fact that Will Ferrell has got this incredible way with women. Everywhere, his wife is incredibly glamorous. Everywhere he goes, all these women are falling at his feet. The gag being that Will Ferrell is this, you know, dorky guy, and nobody can quite understand why it is that he has this magnetic charm of women. The only thing that makes that gag funny is Mark Wahlberg's reaction to it. So I think Mark Wahlberg is actually a great comic talent. I still can't get my hat about Will Ferrell. The film itself is schizophrenic in that the stuff which is the humour of those two people together in awkward situations is funny because of Mark Wahlberg, and the plot, which is completely perfunctory until the final moment when suddenly it turns into this lecture about American economics, is overwrought, to say the least. So 5 out of 10 at best.
Nick, watching live, asks, am I imagining things or is Simon's microphone louder than Mark's? Is it because he's more important? Had you noticed that? I hadn't noticed that.
Had anybody else noticed that Simon's louder than me? They're all nodding.
That's your usual count, isn't it? Five versus 295.
That's right.
And welcome back to the Centre for Life at Newcastle for more wittertainment and movie reviews with Mark Kermode and Simon Mayo.
Thank you, announcer Lee.
Very good. Fat Kev says, could you next time go to a bigger venue next time you come to Newcastle? It looks excellent. You can watch it online. Just so small that there is hardly anyone able to get tickets. Some of us would have loved to have been there. It's a pretty big banqueting hall, isn't it?
It is. How about holding 1,000 people, I think, is pretty impressive.
Next time we'll go to St. James's Park.
Very good.
How about that?
No idea what that means, but yes, that'll be great.
Do you just want to explain, announcer Lee, what that means?
It's the local cathedral of sport, apparently.
Yeah, it was the third word in that phrase that it was the one that failed me slightly.
We understand Peter Beardsley is listening, so we'd like to say hello, Peter. Somewhat reluctantly. It's all right, Mark, I'll explain later.
Okay.
This from Peter Baldwin, LLB, honours European Warwick, currently on holiday in British Columbia. As I found myself this week driving through picturesque British Columbia while listening to last week's podcast and to the comments of a Canadian listener, I thought it was worth recounting something which occurred at a screening of Scott Pilgrim in Vancouver last week. One of the trailers was for The Devil, the upcoming M. Night
Shyamalan Ding Dong
horror flick featuring 5 people stuck in an elevator.
Which, incidentally, we can't review this week because they haven't press screened it, which is interesting.
The trailer came onto the screen with no introduction, no credits or title. And it wasn't until the end of the trailer that it proudly announced that this was an M. Night
Shyamalan Ding Dong
film.
Although I don't think he directed it. I think he just produced and wrote the story.
This revelation was accompanied by a communal and highly audible groan from across the audience, quickly followed by shared laughter at the inadvertent but unmistakable collective review of M&S's recent work. It is the communal moment, things like this, that still make going to the cinema worthwhile, even if it is a bit sad to observe such a consensus about quite how far M&S's star.
Yeah, but the thing about Shyamalan is that he did make interesting films, and the guy who likes The Village, and I think at some point he might get it back together again. And if you have made films of the caliber of the films that he made, there's no reason why he shouldn't do it again. It's just that after he made The Lady in the Water or The Lady in the Lake, whatever it was called, Lady in the Water, which was like watching somebody torching their career and was a really depressing experience. He has got into a very bad loop, but he may come out of it. He may come out of it. And I haven't seen The Devil yet because I haven't press screened it. I'll go and pay to see it in the cinema, and I'll give you the review next week.
What else would you like to review?
Okay, so I'm Still Here. This is the poster for I'm Still Here, which is a picture of what appears to be a tramp, which is, of course, Joaquin Phoenix. And the tagline at the top is, What Happened to Joaquin Phoenix? As you will know, if you...
Is that a newspaper that you've held up there?
It is, Simon.
Is it
it's a broadsheet newspaper. Yes, it probably is The Guardian, is it? But I'm holding up for the poster. So the story is that in real life, or maybe not in real life, Joaquin Phoenix, who's a very fine actor, who did an incredible sort of Johnny Cash version in Walk the Line, he made this film Two Lovers, and after he'd made Two Lovers, he announced that he was retiring from acting, and many of you will have followed this, you know, on the news story. So I'm not going to act anymore. What I'm going to do is I'm going to become a rapper. And he grew a beard, and he grew his hair really shaggy, and he became really, he put on an awful lot of weight. And Casey Affleck, to whom he is related by marriage, was following him around with a video camera. The question was, is he actually retiring from acting? Is he actually trying to become a rapper? Or is the whole thing an elaborate hoax? And at the very, very beginning, everybody, the signals were out that the whole thing was an elaborate hoax. Anyway, finally now we have the movie I'm Still Here, which is the end product of this either art project or descent into madness, depending on which way you feel. So what happened was he said, I'm not going to act anymore. He started rapping. He was, as I think is no surprise to anybody, a genuinely terrible rapper with apparently no talent whatsoever. He went to see P. Diddy or Puff Daddy or whatever he's particularly being called at the moment to ask Puff Daddy if he would produce his album, to which the answer was not in a million years. And he was being followed around all the time by this camera. Meantime, he appeared to be, at least as far as from what you can see on camera, descending into various states of degenerate madness. And what we see in the film is him shouting, screaming, ranting, abusing drugs, abusing women, behaving really badly, and perhaps most significantly appearing on the David Letterman show, because they use in the film the David Letterman clip, which has now become a sort of internet sensation. It's been all over YouTube and everything, which we'll play you the clip from now. What happened was essentially David Letterman was doing his chat show. The movie Two Lovers was being promoted. He had gone out to promote the movie. He went on the Letterman chat chat show with beard and glasses and shaggy hair in a state of, shall we say, incoherence. Here's how Letterman reacted.
You've got a nice beard going. And
oh, yeah, thank you.
How is that, the beard?
In my way.
Well, is it comfortable? Is it itchy? Is it? Are you pleased with it?
I'm okay with it, but now you're making me feel weird about it.
I'm sorry, I'm making you feel weird about it? I can't be the first one to make you feel weird about it.
No, I guess not.
I saw this movie the other night. Tremendous. What a tremendous film. You and who else is in it? What's her name? Beautiful, lovely... Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, yeah, Gwyneth Paltrow. Vanessa Shaw.
What can you tell us about your days with the Unabomber? It's just a little joke. Now, I heard that that you were leaving acting, and I said to myself, that's too bad. So here's my hope that after some time off, and I think you're taking a little time off tonight, I'm hopeful that you will reconsider and come back to acting, because you're just, you know, nobody really better than you are. And Joaquin, I'm sorry you couldn't be here tonight.
He's funny, you're funny. He's a funny dude.
So, the Letterman clip is essentially the highlight of the film, in which the whole gag of the film is the whole thing a put-up? Is it a mockumentary? Is it a documentary about somebody genuinely abandoning acting and going mad? Or is it actually a great big smug in-joke? I think it's pretty clear that it's generally the latter. I mean, the whole thing is, so much of it looks terribly staged. And the problem with it is not, is it, isn't it, is it true, isn't it true? The problem in the end is it entertaining? Is it interesting? Is it fascinating? Is it engrossing? To which the answer is no, not at all, absolutely not, and I really wish it was. It's 108 minutes long, and had it been a 60-minute spoof documentary, it might have held it together. You know, did any of you see Anvil recently? You know, the film Anvil, the story of Anvil.
Great, which is title.
People described it as the real-life Spinal Tap, and it was this just wonderful documentary about this band in which, when you were watching it, you kept thinking, is this real? I mean, the fact that one of the characters is actually called Rob Reiner made you think maybe it is a Spinal Tap spoof, but it was brilliant because you watched the whole thing. Do this band really exist? How come I don't know about them? Are they putting it on for the camera, or are they really like that? And that was actually genuinely very interesting. The problem with I'm Still Here is it isn't interesting. It just looks like a bunch of people enjoying a joke far too much. The bits of it that you need to take seriously actually sort of border on the really distasteful. There are scenes in which they bring in cool girls, and it's an awfully horrible laddish tone to the whole thing, which I don't think has any sense of what it's doing. After a while, you get very bored of being in the presence of Joaquin Phoenix in this state, whether or not he's doing an act, which I think he clearly is, whether he's doing an act or whether he's actually descending into a state of madness, it doesn't make any difference. His company is terribly dull. There have been various lawsuits around the film, all of which have been sort of settled quietly and out of court to do with credit. And in the end, at its worst moments, the film descends into being Borat. There is a moment in the film which involves a bottom-face interface, which clearly is in there because they've seen Borat and they thought, well, that wrestling scene is funny.
A bottom-face interface.
So I don't need to go any further. I thought about that phrase very carefully before saying it and moving on swiftly, so let's not go back. But it is one of those things which you think, I went in really wanting to enjoy this. It's going to be a documentary that has something to say about fame. It's going to be a mockumentary that's actually, you know, an ironic comment on what it's like being famous. And actually, after 15 minutes of it, you go, you know what? At very best, this is a smug, self-satisfied art project. At very worst, it is a bunch of home movies of a bunch of people in whose company I don't actually want to spend any time. It thinks it's clever and funnier than it actually is. And the minute Letterman comes on screen, and he's on screen, when they show that clip, it's about 2 or 3 minutes long, Letterman just goes bang, 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 gets all the laughs, all the comedy, gets right under the skin of everything. You think, if you've seen the Letterman clip, you've seen the thing, because everyone watching the Letterman clip thought, is he putting it on? Is it an act? Or is he really being that dorky, shaggy hair thing? The other problem with it is I spent the entire film wanting to comb his hair, because the hair problem really became very distracting for me after a while. So it's a real shame. I wanted it to be entertaining, and it was, in the end, far too long, far too indulgent, far too smug, far too sure of itself, and far, far, far fewer laughs than there should have been.
Simon Fenton, with this email, I like Mark's chair. Could someone please give him a white fluffy cat to stroke? to complete the image, which is good. Okay, so what else is new?
Can we do Winter's Bone? Because Winter's Bone is a film which I would like everyone to go and see. It's a really, really interesting movie. The story is fairly slim, set in the Ozark Mountains up in Missouri, in a sort of mountain community. And at the beginning of it, we meet this young girl who is essentially living in a very remote community, living in a house in which she has two children that she's taken care of and a mother who is not capable of taking care of herself. The police turn up, a policeman turns up, and says, your errant father has been arrested and is out on bail, and he has put up for bail your house, and if he doesn't turn up at the trial, which is impending, you are going to lose the house. She then goes off to visit her various family members, which appears to be everybody else in the sort of disparate community around there in the woods up in the mountains, appears to be related to each other, to go and find out where her father is, because her father has to turn up at the trial, otherwise she's going to lose her house. And everywhere she goes, she meets this same strange sense of silence and threat, the rules being everyone talks the same, everyone knows the same thing, and nobody talks to the police. Here's a clip.
We seen the law was out here this afternoon. Everything all right?
He's hunting for Dad.
Hunting Jessup, is he? You know where he's at?
No.
You sure about that?
Yes.
All right. All right, well, I guess you didn't have nothing to tell him then, did you?
I wouldn't tell him nothing if I did.
It's a really interesting film. It's directed by Deborah Granick, and there was an interview with her recently in which she said it had done very well at Sundance, and it had been developed partly through the Sundance Festival. And she said that she specifically didn't want the Sundance label over it, because you know if you hear that something is a festival favourite means seen by nobody at all, in the same way that, you know, Alan Frank once said this, you know, glorious monochrome means not in colour, right? So festival favourite is always a label that you don't want to hang around a film. And it's based on a story by Daniel Woodrell, who wrote the story on which Ang Lee's Ride with the Devil is based. And she described it as being like a fairy tale. It's like a fable in which a young girl has to go off into the woods and face all these sort of dark, unnamed fears and somehow bring back some trophy of her courage. And the whole thing does have a terribly mythical feel to it. It is a film in which atmosphere is far more important than the plot. The plot itself is fairly slender, although there's a quest that has to be gone on, and you kind of have an idea where it's going to go to. But essentially what you have is like a Western hero figure embodied in the body of this young and very, very sort of forthright girl who understands that there is something that she has to do, and she has no question about having to do this, no matter what the things that she's up against is. And the things I liked about it, firstly, it's shot on location, and the location is in every frame of the film. It absolutely oozes location. All the best movies, I think, are tied up with location. When I think of things like Local Hero, I think specifically of Pennon, that place, the village where it's shot. When I think of Exorcist, I think of Georgetown. When you think of this, it could only have been filmed on location. The second thing is it's very much a film about the sound of the voices, the cadence of the voices, getting the voices right, and the music of the voices. I don't know whether any of you saw recently, a couple of years ago, there's a film called White Lightning, which is the best tap dancing and murder movie of recent years. And believe me, it's a very wide field. And one of the things about that film was, the Jesco White story sort of partly imagined, was it brilliantly used music as part of its scene setting. Watching Winter's Bone, nothing in it looks like it was set dressed. Every shack, every remote cabin, every burned down house that they come across looks like it was actually there and they found it. I don't know how much set dressing was actually involved, but it all smacks of authenticity. It has a real realism, but it's a real poetic realism that is very much like a fairy tale thing. And the sense of its music is completely right. There's one wonderful scene when she turns up at a house in which there's a group of people all sitting around playing instruments, playing an old version of Come All You Fair and Tender Ladies, which has that wonderful sense of it's a ballad, but on the other hand, there's threat and there's death and there's loss and everything involved in it. As it goes on, and as the sort of the mythical part of it becomes stronger and stronger, it moves into territory that nods, I suppose, to those, you know, the great archetypes of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Southern Comfort, but only nods towards them. And there is a sense of impending horror which is always tonal rather than being anything revelatory. And you really feel at the end of it that you've lived in this world. And I thought that for something that was a slight film, for something that was clearly made on a low budget, it was a really artful piece that you felt that you were right in the middle of the drama all the way through. It's a terrific performance. The lead actress is called Jennifer Lawrence, who is really sort of mesmerizing and underplays it beautifully. And it's a very, very fine, atmospheric, moody, strangely disturbing piece of work.
Is she a bit like Jodie Foster? I've only seen the trails and read stuff about it, but she comes over a little bit like early Jodie Foster.
Well, I mean, I suppose in as much as you're saying without somebody who by their presence suggests that they have, you know, they have greatness ahead of them and seems to have an authority beyond their years, then yes, I would agree with that. But it's so much about the cadence of the speech, the sound of the mountain, the look of the place, the fact that it has an authenticity which is poetic. I mean, I really liked it. And, you know, if you get a chance and you have a choice between seeing The Other Guys and this, see this.
We have a question, I think. We certainly had a hand up. Yes, sir, what's your name?
Actually, on what Mark was saying, I...
Sorry, can you just... What's your name, sir?
My name is Martin.
Yes, Martin.
I read an article in The Independent on this very movie today, and it did, in fact, say that the look of the film, the shacks and everything, they were authentic, They used a lot of local people as cast members.
Yeah.
Got onto the Ozark accent as well, which you also picked out. Marilyn Monroe in Bus Stop played someone from the Ozark area, and she won a lot of plaudits for her authenticity of accent in that particular film.
Can I just ask, A, why it is that he isn't doing the film reviews? But secondly, saying that it is interesting how in films like that, the cadence of the speech and the cadence of the music absolutely become one. And I mean, it is really, really important that that stuff is right, because the sound of it, the music of the speech is absolutely crucial. And it doesn't surprise me to find out that those locations were genuinely stumbled. But they all look, I mean, for a start, they all look like they've been there for 50, 60 years.
Mike in Chicago. Hi, guys. Regarding I'm Still Here, it sounds like Mark hasn't heard that director Casey Affleck
has now officially
came clean in a New York Times interview yesterday. He basically said almost all of it is fake, saying it's a terrific performance. It's the performance of his career.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because when we saw the film, they were just on the verge of saying we were about to reveal whether it is a mockumentary or not. But there was, what's the revelation? It's clearly a mockumentary. It's clearly staged. I mean, there are a couple of scenes in it that are, as I said, the Borat scenes, in which there's absolutely no question. So it's not a surprise. And in a way, that ought to be a great revelation when you go, oh, wow, the whole thing's a fake. And in fact, you go,
How does that go again? Just one more time. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Okay. We've got a couple of minutes left. What do you want to mention?
Very quickly, there's two horror films out. One, F, which is a low-budget British horror movie. Another, which is La Horde, which is, obviously French, maybe Belgian horror movie. So La Horde is a zombie, the French movie, which is a zombie movie, which is essentially, it looks like there's a grain of an idea in it at the beginning. There's a group of policemen go round to a block of flats where they're going to wreak vengeance for a friend of theirs who's been killed. When they're in the block of flats, they look out the window, they realise that the whole of the country has been overrun by zombies. The zombies break in, they all have to get together to fight the zombies. It is worth noting only for the fact that it has an extremely high body count. It was one of the very few movies in which even I thought, okay, you know, enough now. Because the whole film is like the end of Brain Dead. There's a scene in Brain Dead in which a guy walks through a crowd of zombies he's got a Flymo and he turns it upside down to move through the crowd of zombies. And apparently it was at the time the most blood ever used in a scene. It was a comedy scene. And in the case of La Horde, there's an idea in there that somehow maybe the zombies are the dispossessed, but whatever it is all gets lost under all the fuss. The other thing is F, which is this film, a low-budget British movie in which a teacher, and you said this is something that will strike a chord, in which a teacher gives a kid an F for fail, and the kid then hits the teacher. The teacher then becomes terrified of kids. He's just turned the clock towards me. Becomes terrified of kids. A little bit later on, he's teaching a class load of kids, and he's worrying about hoodies. He's worrying about the hoodie threat. And the next thing you know is the school is under siege, apparently, by hoodies. It's interesting because there is a whole hoodie subgenre. There was Eden Lake, which was that film about we're terrified of kids. That had a very good punchline in which the kids say, not my kids. There was that film recently, Cherry Tree Lane, in which all nice middle-class family hoodies break in. Interesting thing with watching this film is because the director is an interesting director. He knows his genre. It's a very fine performance. At the beginning of it, I thought it's very interesting. Okay. It's not going to be the obvious film you thought it was, and then actually it turned out to be the obvious film I thought it was, which is a shame because actually watching it, I thought of a more interesting film than it could have been.
All right. Thank you very much, Lee. That first one. That one. No, that one.
Yep. And finally, the movie of the week.
Oh, well, Winter's Bone. Go see Winter's Bone. Make Winter's Bone a hit.
Lee, your final piece of script.
Yep. That's it from Simon and Mark from the Centre for Life at Newcastle. Five Lives Septemberfest, and thanks very much to a great audience.
And that was the Wittertainment podcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye from the good people of Newcastle.
Hey!
Folks, thank you very much indeed for coming. That was fantastic. Apparently it sounded great on air. I hope you've enjoyed being here. I hope you download the podcast and enjoy it. Mark, of course, will stay for hours to answer your questions. And he'll also take you out for a meal and buy you a drink and come round to your house and sing songs to your children.
On digital and online, this is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.